Imagine like a brilliant local garage band. Every single member is just this world-class generational talent on their instrument.
Right, totally.
But they absolutely refuse to sign with a major label. They won't hire a manager, and they refuse to brand themselves because secretly, every single member just wants to play solo gigs.
Yeah, which is it's a massive problem if you want to scale.
Exactly. And today, for you listening, we are looking at why the Indian accounting sector is dangerously close to being that exact band, and what it actually takes to finally build a global empire.
It's a genuinely fascinating dilemma. So for our deep dive today, we are unpacking the July 2026 issue of the Bombay Chartered Accountant Journal, specifically Volume 58, Issue 4.
Right.
And the whole focus here is this unflinching look at the globalization of Indian CA firms. And then we're going to systematically go through the latest tax, legal, and societal rulings that are, shaping the landscape right now.
Yeah, so we are skipping the usual preamble. We're just jumping straight into the deep end for you today. The journal actually opens its Namaskar section with this Sanskrit quote from the Shishupalvada.
Oh, yeah, the quote about excellence.
Right. It says, "That which attains newness every single moment, that alone is the form of true excellence." Which I love because it frames adaptation not as some, desperate survival tactic, but as the literal definition of excellence.
Which sets up editor Sunil Gabbawala's incredibly blunt assessment perfectly. I mean, he just lays out exactly where the Indian accounting profession stands today.
He does not hold back.
No, he doesn't. He points to this massive historical missed opportunity. Back in 2002, a global accounting giant basically collapsed under the weight of a massive scandal.
Right, the whole Arthur Andersen thing.
Exactly. And overnight, the Big Five became the Big Four, and that created a huge vacuum in the global professional services market.
And Gabbawala's argument is that an institution from the global south, specifically India, should have just stepped right into that vacuum. But the window closed.
Yeah, it closed. And the distinction he makes is super crucial. India has absolutely mastered the art of exporting exceptional professional talent. I mean, you look at the engine rooms of the world's largest corporations, and Indian professionals are running them.
Oh, for sure. The talent is everywhere.
But the country has fundamentally struggled to export an institution. The domestic accounting sector is still just heavily fragmented. You have thousands of these sole proprietorships or small partnerships driven by like individual
It's
heroes.
solo gigs from our garage band analogy.
Exactly. Individual heroes who tightly control their own client relationships rather than building unified, scalable
The
organizations.
talent is there, but without a unified brand or, centralized governance and shared capital, you can't command the global stage.
Right.
And this is exactly the structural challenge that the new leadership team for 2026-27 is stepping in to navigate.
Yeah.
We've got CA Kinjal Shah as president and CA Manager Telang as vice president.
And their mandate is basically to steer the society through this totally necessary evolution. Because, as contributors like Milan Mehta point out, this evolution is just, it's no longer optional.
No, it's really not. I mean, Method points out that India is projected to be the third largest economy by 2030. The clients have already globalized.
The numbers back that up aggressively, too.
Yeah. There are over 1,700 global capability centers, GCCs, operating in India right now, and they're generating $64.6 billion in revenue.
Which is staggering.
Yeah.
But if Indian CA firms only provide, commoditized compliance or back-end manpower for those centers, they are going to be relegated to the bottom of the value chain.
Right, just doing the grunt work.
Exactly. So Mehta's thesis is that firms absolutely must shift from being compliance-centric to becoming capability-led global institutions, providing integrated multi-jurisdictional advice.
And then Sheree Contractor builds on this, arguing that consolidation is literally the only path forward. You have to merge these fragmented structures to even compete with the dominant multinational firms.
Right, which brings us to P.R. Ramesh. He introduces this concept that I found fascinating, the fifth firm.
The fifth firm. It sounds like a movie title.
It does, but it's this massive theoretical Indian global player that can sit right alongside the Big Four. To build this, he says you need a what he calls a dual-track regulatory design.
Okay, balancing strictly regulated audit services with highly flexible corporate structures for consulting.
Exactly.
But wait, I need to stop you there. Because how on earth do you balance strict, highly regulated, independent audit work with the fast and loose, high growth world of tech consulting under one roof? Doesn't that create a massive conflict of interest?
It absolutely would if you kept them in the exact same legal bucket, which is why this dual-track design is, it's basically the only way to solve the puzzle of the fifth firm. You have to physically and legally separate the corporate structures.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so the audit practice remains a highly regulated partnership. That ensures uncompromising independence, right? It's strictly governed by the Institute.
Right, keeping it clean.
But meanwhile, the consulting and technology advisory arms operate under entirely separate, flexible corporate structures. That allows for outside funding, rapid agility, aggressive growth, all that stuff.
But if they are separate legal entities, how are they actually one firm?
Well, what ties them together is a single global brand and shared institutional trust. It is a highly engineered firewall. Honestly, it's the only way to achieve international scale without violating professional ethics on the audit side.
Okay, so if that is the architectural blueprint, how do you actually pour the concrete? Because Dinesh Kanabar tackles the talent side of this, and he argues that true globalization means building diverse local teams abroad. You don't just take an Indian team and put them on a plane to London or New York.
No, because exporting Indian staff is just, it's an extension of the old manpower model. To build a firm that actually travels well, you have to attract and retain senior local professionals in those foreign markets.
Because they know the landscape.
Exactly. A local partner in Dubai or Singapore understands the cultural and regulatory nuances in a way an expat simply won't. But to attract that tier of local talent, you need systemic leadership architectures, not just a founder-led hierarchy where all roads lead back to one boss in Mumbai.
Right. And Mayank Lakhani points out that technology is the foundation that allows that whole architecture to function. Enterprise-grade tech, secure cloud infrastructure, AI, these are not just luxuries for the IT department anymore.
No, they're the core infrastructure. You need them to deliver standardized services across borders so a client gets the exact same experience in Tokyo as they do in Delhi.
Which brings us to Vaibhav Manek's article. He tackles the massive elephant in the room, financing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you pay for AI and global partners? He notes that private equity is increasingly circling professional services because of the predictable revenues.
And the high client stickiness, yeah.
Wait, private equity and accounting. PE investors demand aggressive, rapid growth and ruthless efficiency. Doesn't that directly threaten the uncompromising independence you just said was required for statutory audits? Like, if a PE firm wants a 5x return, they might pressure an auditor to look the other way to keep a lucrative client.
It is a severe tension, definitely. But attracting private capital necessitates what are called alternative practice structures. This ties directly back to that dual track design we were just talking about.
Oh, so the firewall again?
Right. The structure is specifically designed to wall off the audit function from investor pressures. PE money goes into the technology, the consulting arms, the real estate, but the governance, the decision making, and the compensation of the audit practice remains fiercely independent and walled off from the PE investors.
Okay, that makes sense. And then Kitandala closes this whole strategic loop by warning that as Indian firms adopt this massive institutionalization, they cannot lose their soul.
Which is so important.
They have to retain your unique advantage, which has always been highly personalized, integrated relationship management.
Yeah, you can build the biggest machine in the world, but if it feels like a machine to the client, you've completely lost.
So let's say a mid-sized firm is listening to this right now, and they are fired up. They want to go global. Raman Jokhikar provides a self-assessment diagnostic tool to see if you're actually ready.
And it is a ruthless reality check.
It really is. He uses this traffic light system. Green if you can answer his questions with concrete evidence. Amber if your answer is just aspirational. And red if the honest answer is just, we don't know.
But the standout metric in his diagnostic is what he calls the 11 p.m. test.
I am so obsessed with this concept. The 11 p.m. test asks, would a junior team member in an overseas office raise a difficult, potentially embarrassing client complication at 11 p.m.? Or would they just find a quiet workaround because no senior partner is awake to watch them?
It's the ultimate litmus test for corporate culture. And honestly, you can apply it to your own team right now, no matter what industry you are in. When you operate across multiple time zones, founders can't oversee every single decision. Building a true institution, which goes back to the editor's opening point, is incredibly difficult precisely because culture has to replace direct supervision. Uncompromising quality and ethics have to be internalized by every team member.
Jokhikar ends with one ultimate diagnostic question. If you stripped away all your domestic advantages, your long-standing local client relationships, your old boys network, your regulatory protections, what would a foreign client actually see when you walk through their door?
It totally removes the comfort of domestic incumbency. If you step onto a level playing field in a foreign market, do you actually have a superior capability, or are you just used to playing with a home field advantage?
That idea of the 11 p.m. test, doing the right thing when no one is watching, focusing on the actual underlying truth rather than just surface-level workarounds, that's actually the exact lens through which Indian tax tribunals are making their rulings right now.
Yeah, that transition in the journal is seamless.
It is. The journal walks through several critical domestic taxation updates, and there's a very clear pattern of courts looking for the fundamental truth of a transaction.
Let's break down how that is actually playing out in the tribunals.
First, we have Ratcha Jain versus DCIT. The tribunal ruled that a tax assessment is void ab initio, meaning it is completely invalid from the very start. Why? Because the mandatory notice under Section 143(2) was issued by an officer who did not have the proper jurisdiction over the taxpayer.
Void ab initio is a powerful legal concept. It essentially means the tax authority committed a fundamental foul before the game even started. If the officer doesn't have the legal authority to issue the notice, nothing that follows matters. The courts are acting as very strict referees here regarding the government's boundaries.
But then look at how they treat the taxpayer. In Vasudeva Rao versus ITO, the ruling states capital gains cannot be taxed if there was no actual money changing hands and no absolute transfer of possession. You can't tax a phantom transaction.
It's just common sense, right?
Exactly. And then, Javaji Nagadarshan versus ITO. A taxpayer claimed a deduction because they reinvested their capital gains. They were missing some minor procedural documents. The tribunal said, you cannot deny the deduction just for missing paperwork if the money was actually substantially invested.
Notice the contrast there. The tribunal throws a red card at the tax officer for lacking jurisdiction, but they give the taxpayer grace on minor documentation errors as long as the core investment actually occurred. They are prioritizing the substance of the financial transaction over pure procedural technicalities.
Exactly. It continues with DCIT versus Kutir Navanchandra Patel. The tax department tried to argue that because someone used borrowed funds to invest in shares, it automatically made it a taxable business activity rather than an investment. The tribunal struck that down. Just because you borrowed the money doesn't change the fundamental nature of buying shares.
It is a highly practical view of how finance actually works.
We see this practicality applying to the NGO sector as well. And Nazm Educational Trust versus CITE confirmed that teaching Islamic studies and the Arabic language definitively counts as an educational activity eligible for tax registration.
Right, focusing on the actual function of the trust.
And finally, Bose Saravanan versus DCIT. A professional made bank deposits specifically to pay their clients' taxes, and they had the challenge and matching debits to prove it. The tax department tried to claim it was unexplained money.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the tribunal practically rolled its eyes and said no. The paper trail clearly shows this is client tax money.
The overarching theme in domestic tax right now is that if the fundamental intent and action align with the law, the tribunals will not let you be penalized for having your jersey untucked.
The journal also explores international tax decisions, which is vital for any firm trying to build that global fifth firm. In GE Engine Services LLC versus ACIT, the ruling confirms that single-member LLCs from the U.S. are entitled to benefits under the DTAA.
Right. The DTAA is the Double Taxation Avoidance Agreement. It ensures that a company operating across borders isn't taxed twice on the same income by two different countries.
The ruling also noted that getting paid for offshore repairs is not taxable in India unless it fulfills the Make Available Clause. Basically, unless the foreign company is making technical knowledge permanently available to the Indian entity, you can't tax it as technical fees.
Which is a huge relief for offshore service providers.
This is have Milestone Systems AS versus ACIT. This is a big one. It ruled that selling software through Indian distributors on a principal-to-principal basis does not create a dependent agent permanent establishment.
Okay, let's translate that jargon because it is a massive point of friction in international business.
Redo.
A dependent agent permanent establishment is essentially the tax authority saying, look, Your local distributor in India is so tightly controlled by your foreign headquarters that they aren't truly independent. They are basically your local branch office. Therefore, we are going to tax your foreign headquarters as if you physically set up shop here.
Ah, I see.
So this ruling protects foreign software companies, stating that just using a local distributor doesn't automatically mean you've set up a taxable local branch.
Before we leave taxes, there is a fascinating high court decision.
Yeah.
Manav Vikas Bahudeshia versus CIT. A medical aid trust filed its audit report 687 days late. That is nearly 2 years.
Wow, that's a massive delay.
But the High Court condoned the delay. Why? Because there were bona fide, genuine reasons behind it.
It proves that the courts are willing to consider the specific human context behind delays, especially for entities providing public utility. They aren't just blind machines processing deadlines.
And that idea of looking past the surface paperwork to recognize the underlying human reality is spilling over aggressively into corporate and allied laws. We have a ruling in Kulsum Nisha versus State of UP. The court ruled that marriage cannot be the sole ground to exclude a daughter from being considered a dependent for compassionate allotment of a job or resources after a parent's death.
Which is a significant modernization. It legally acknowledges that a daughter's relationship and dependency on her family doesn't just magically vanish the moment she gets married.
But the ruling that really stops you in your tracks is Shishupal versus Surjit.
Oh, this one is huge.
It is. The court was tasked with calculating compensation, and to do so, they fixed the minimum economic value of a homemaker's domestic work at 30,000 rupees per month, assigning a specific, tangible, legal rupee value to a homemaker's domestic work is a massive, fascinating shift in how invisible labor is quantified.
It is a profound change in jurisprudence. Historically, domestic labor has been economically invisible. Because there is no formal paycheck, the legal system has really struggled to quantify the loss if a homemaker is injured or killed in an accident.
Right. How do you put a number on that?
Exactly. But by establishing a hard baseline of 30,000 rupees per month, the courts are creating a mathematical foundation. This radically impacts how tribunals calculate insurance payouts, motor accident claims, and alimony. It is the legal system formally recognizing the very real economic engine running within households.
Speaking of formalizing value under corporate laws, the journal highlights Invesco Developing Markets Fund versus Z Entertainment. The ruling establishes that a corporate board has a mandatory obligation to call an extraordinary general meeting, or EGM, upon a valid requisition by shareholders.
And furthermore, civil courts are completely barred from interfering in matters that belong to the National Company Law Tribunal, the NCLT.
Right.
This is a strict reinforcement of shareholder democracy. Management cannot refuse to call a meeting just because they don't like the motives of the shareholders asking for it. And by barring civil courts, it prevents companies from using random local courts to endlessly delay corporate disputes. Everything stays centralized in the NCLT.
This entire journey of formalizing value and elevating standards leads us perfectly to the final section of the journal, Profession, Ethics, and Society Updates. The Institute of Chartered Accountants of India, the ICAI, is restructuring its code of ethics. Volume 3 specifically introduces ethics standards for sustainability assurance,
which is a direct, unavoidable response to global market demands.
I have to ask, does this mean green reporting and ESG environmental, social, and governance claims are no longer just a slick PR exercise? Like, are we actually treating a company's claims about their carbon footprint with the same ruthless audit scrutiny as their bank statements?
Absolutely. Sustainability has officially moved out of the marketing department and firmly into the compliance department. The ethical burden on auditors has expanded massively. When a firm signs off on an ESG report now, they are held to rigorous, standardized ethical frameworks.
So no more greenwashing?
No, it is no longer just voluntary, feel-good disclosure. It is formal, legally binding assurance. If you verify a green claim that turns out to be false, your license is on the line.
Which explains the next update perfectly. The IAASB has launched a public consultation on rules for working with external experts. Modern audits are so complex now, an auditor can't know everything.
Right. To audit an ESG claim, you need environmental scientists. To audit a tech firm, you need cybersecurity experts.
Standardizing how auditors rely on those external experts, how you verify their competence and integrate their findings without blindly trusting them, is critical for maintaining the integrity of the audit.
It really is.
The journal wraps up with the BCAS Foundation's annual activities. And this ties beautifully back to where we started about building an institution. The Society organized an International Yoga Day celebration on June 21st, 2026, guided by accredited trainer Pradeep Thakkar.
That's great.
They also disbursed 37,500 rupees in scholarships to selected beneficiaries. And there was a highly generous 21 lakh rupee contribution from CA Anil Kumar Desai to the Sri P.N. Shah Memorial Endowment Fund. Finally, they highlight the future-ready CA summit held in Vadodara, bringing practitioners together to focus on firm growth.
You know, you might wonder why a technical journal includes updates on Yoga Day and scholarships, but think back to the editorial. How do you build a global firm that survives the 11 p.m. test? You build culture.
Right.
These activities, community building, health initiatives, supporting the next generation through scholarships, that is the actual fabric of an institution. It is not just about tax codes. It is about creating a unified professional community.
We have covered massive ground today. We started with a theoretical ambition of building the Indian fifth firm and unpacked the dual-track mechanics required to pull it off.
We explored private equity funding, navigated the substance over form rulings of the tax tribunals, and examined the profound legal shifts that are quantifying human value right down to the domestic labor of a homemaker.
The through line connecting all of this is maturity. Whether it is a mid-sized firm realizing they need local partners overseas, a tax tribunal looking past an untucked jersey to find the truth of a transaction, or an auditor applying rigorous ethics to a sustainability report, the global market is demanding deeper structural integrity. We will leave you with this final thought. We talked about Raman Jokhikar's 11 p.m. test earlier. What your junior staffer does when a crisis hits and no senior partner is watching. Think about applying that test across international borders.
That's a scary thought.
What if the true measure of a global professional isn't the number of passport stamps they have collected, but whether their ethical core remains completely identical when they step into a new market where the local rules are suddenly much more relaxed? Consider your own workplace. If you stripped away all your home field advantages, how would your team survive the 11 p.m. test in a foreign market?